Even if you're not interested in mixed martial arts, I encourage you to listen to part of this story because it's not really about mixed martial arts, although Ariel Helwani's path has been an interesting one, trying to climb up through a sport that hasn't, over time, had a lot of mainstream credibility and bringing real journalism to it. So I want to have a conversation with him about Dana White's bullying tactics, about the things that he's had to endure as sort of a one-man band trying to accomplish journalism around people who don't necessarily want to understand or care about journalism. So before we get to that, we ask you to rate, subscribe, and review, and also please support the people who support us, the sponsors who keep this afloat so all this extra content can get to you, and we're going to be creating more and more, doing more of these events. We can only do them. We can only come to your city if ZipRecruiter and TESO are supported by you and they're supporting us. So, Mike, tell the people about ZipRecruiter here before we get to Ariel Helwani.
Guys, hiring is challenging, but there is one place where you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect qualified candidates. And that place is ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. No, they don't. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find the people with the right experience and invites them to apply for your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. And right now, South Beach Session listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEACH. ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
The story you're about to hear is an interesting one, whether you care about mixed martial arts or not. This is a guy whose way of doing business is something that I admire. And we continue to try to bring you interesting topics with interesting people. Basically, that's the path of South Beach Sessions. So here's Ariel Helwani. I hope you enjoy his story. So this guy here is someone who is unique in that he went into a sport that came out of nowhere and he became the lead journalist with information, with credibility in ways that have sometimes have upset the carnival barker, Dana White, because he does things like report that Brock Lesnar is going to be in a fight, which is information that people want, but it was before Dana White wanted it revealed. Ariel Helwani has done some stuff in UFC with MMA that you have not seen. His MMA show, new episode every Monday and Wednesday. You can listen, download, and subscribe on the ESPN app or Apple Podcasts. He's also got the show with Chael Sonnen, Ariel and the Bad Guy on ESPN Plus and the ESPN app. I wanted to talk to you a little bit before we get to how uncomfortable it is to fight the commissioner in a sport you care about, in a career you care about. How did you arrive here? What is your path?
I grew up a sports fan, but I loved sports broadcasting. I always looked to, you know, I looked up to the broadcasters, Costas, Marv Albert. These are people that I really admired. I grew up in Montreal, and I remember being in the ninth grade, and I was reading a textbook. We were supposed to be reading a textbook, but in my particular case, I had an issue of Sports Illustrated in between, and I was reading that and focusing on that. And it was one of these issues where they were breaking down like the best schools in America for X, Y, and Z. And there was a little blurb, I'll never forget, that stated that Syracuse University is the best school for sports broadcasting. And a light went off in my head. I said, wow, you can actually go to school and try to become a sports broadcaster. That's what I want to do. So I decided then and there that I wanted to go to Syracuse. And when I got to Syracuse in 2001, I realized that everyone kind of wanted to be the same thing. Everyone wanted to be the next Costas and Marv Albert. Everyone wanted to do baseball, basketball, and football. And I've always been someone who likes to go in the opposite direction of everyone. And I remember telling my parents in 2001 that in 10 years, I feel like this sport, MMA, that I'm a big fan of, I was a big combat sports fan in addition to all the traditional sports, I feel like this sport is going to be mainstream and there's going to be some guy in some office, some executive who says, I know nothing about this sport, but I want the guy. Get me the guy. And my goal is to be the guy. I want to be the Howard Cosell of MMA. I remember telling them this vividly. And so that's kind of where it started. I started my own MMA show at Syracuse on one of the student stations. And after graduating, I actually went down the path of TV production. I worked for HBO Sports. I worked on a show for ESPN Classic called Classic Now. And then I eventually, in 2007, made it to Spike TV, which at the time was the home of the UFC, but I was there on, you know, on a contract for production, not anything on camera, no journalism, nothing. And I lasted a week there because I realized that they didn't actually produce anything on their own. They were just getting the content from the UFC. And this didn't interest me at all. So I went into my boss's office after a week and I said, I'm sorry, but it's time for me to go. I don't think that this is the right job for me. He told me, you're making the biggest mistake of your life. You're going to regret this. You're unprofessional. Made me feel really bad. And they made me stick around for a month and a half until they found someone to replace me. And it was during that time that I decided it was the crossroads of my career. I was going to start my own website. I called it jerrypark.com in honor of the late, great Montreal Expos. I rechristened it the Coliseum of Combat Sports. And every morning at 8 a.m., I posted an audio interview with a fighter, and I wanted to prove to the world that I can interview fighters better than anyone, and I wanted to use that website as a way to get a job covering mixed martial arts. So I gave myself from October of 2007 to April 1st of 2008. I devoted everything to that site and getting the best interviews possible. And if I didn't get a job on April 1st, I was going to go back to TV production. And luckily, with 3 days left on my deadline, I got a job from a brand new website. They reached out to me, and that's really how the career started back in 2008.
How scary was it to take the path that others weren't taking? You're coming out of Quebec. You're coming out of, you know, not American broadcasting, even though you're at Syracuse. How scary was that?
Oh, yeah, it was very scary, especially because MMA wasn't a sport that was being covered, you know, by all the mainstream outlets. There weren't a ton of jobs. So I said to myself, okay, I'm going to give myself 6 months to get noticed and to try to get a job covering this sport, because as a fan, I felt like the sport wasn't being covered the right way. I didn't like the coverage. It was, to be honest, it was a little amateurish.
Flimsy. It was flimsy. I remember, Ariel, I've been giving advice to people and telling them how they could take the different path, because everybody wants to do radio or television. And I'm like, get near UFC and start telling the stories about courage. And you chose that path. You saw it before anybody else did.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I love the fight game. I love the fighters. They are incredible interviews. They're very authentic. They don't have like PR people coddling them. So I was very drawn to that. And it was amazing because in 2007, 2008, the social media du jour was MySpace. And so I would just reach out to the Chuck Liddells, the Tito Ortizes, the George St. Pierres of the world via MySpace and send them a message. And these are like the best fighters in the world. And they would write me back and they would do interviews with me. And that's how I got noticed. People were impressed that I was actually going. I would send like 30 messages a day to all the different fighters to try to get all these interviews. But towards the end of my deadline, when I wasn't getting anything in March, I was starting to get really worried that the dream was going to die. But luckily, like I said, with 3 days left, I got that offer. But even till this day, I feel like the dream is going to die tomorrow. I always feel like MMA is the first to go. I've been at multiple websites where they've cut, you know, the MMA department. It's not the NFL. It's not the NBA. So we're always kind of the redheaded stepchild. So it's still nerve-wracking till this day.
What are the details you can give us from the struggle in terms of when you're trying to build it and you're scared, but you're ambitious and this is your dream? It's what you want to do. You want to be the Howard Cosell of MMA. Give us the details of what the struggle looked like, what you were making, how scared you were.
Yeah, well, you know, back in college, there was a main sports station, WAER. That's where all the famous alumni went. And then I went there for a semester, and I realized it was like a country club. I wanted nothing to do with it. That's who broadcast the Syracuse University basketball games and all that stuff, and it just wasn't my style at all. I like to go against the grain. So I actually went to the real sort of indie station that was essentially like a closet in the student center, and there was a phone there, and even back then I was reaching out to guests via their websites and whatnot, and I had a lot of famous fighters come on, but no one was listening. There was a phone there that I could talk to the guests on, but I couldn't make outgoing calls. So I had to get my mom or my sister, who at the time was 11, to act as my producer and call the guest, say, oh, I'm calling on behalf of Ariel Helwani, and then call me via conference, and that's how I would patch them into my show. So that's like the beginning of the struggle, so to speak. And then, of course, while you're trying to make a name for yourself, and I literally did not know a soul in this game, you're trying to prove to them that you are legit, you are professional. There were little things that I felt that would really get me, you know, ahead in this game that would set me apart. Wear a jacket, sometimes wear a tie, have a mic flag, have a guy holding the camera for you. Don't hold the camera and ask questions. These weren't things that were being done
covering the sport. And so initially when I came on, I think a lot of people thought, like, whoa, who's this guy? What's he doing? But then I was labeled as an instigator. I was labeled as a troublemaker, as a problem child, because I was asking questions that I think some people thought as, like, provocative. I just thought, like, I'm here. I have a privilege to talk to these people. I'm going to ask them questions that I want the answers to. But I think the fighters were so used to maybe fans or people that looked up to them or fawned over them that I was viewed as, you know, a quote-unquote instigator. That was a label that I had very early in my career. But it's hogwash. You compare the questions that I was asking to stuff that's being asked in other sports or other beats, nothing controversial at all. So I just had to sort of work my way up. But then the struggle really started once you started to get the jobs. And I lost my, like, so that first job I got in April, they closed the website 6 months later because they sold it to someone else. So now I'm jobless again. Then I went to another website. I went to work for AOL FanHouse. They shut down FanHouse. So it was like one, every time I was feeling comfortable, the MMA site went away. So it was very nervous. And then they ended up selling us off to SB Nation. So there was always struggles. There was always fear. What am I doing with my career? Why am I covering MMA? But I really believed in the sport, and more importantly, I believed in the athletes.
It's not just the sport and the athlete, though, because one of the things that makes you unique is you really believe in the idea of doing journalism there. Like, you must be quite the outsider as somebody who was insistent on having Syracuse journalism principles that you're basically bringing to this wonderful sport that's growing out of the sewer.
Yeah, no, I'm a huge journalism fan. In fact, one of my idols growing up, believe it or not, was Walter Cronkite. And I wasn't around when Walter Cronkite was on the CBS Evening News, but I read a lot of books about him. I've watched a lot of videos about him, documentaries. And my second son is named Walter in honor of Walter Cronkite. And why did I love Walter Cronkite? Because he was the most trusted man in America. When he said something, the world believed it. And I love that. When someone tweets me, hey, did you hear about this story or this fight? I won't believe it unless you report it. That, to me, is the greatest compliment in the world, to have that trust with the audience. And I love, you know, one of my favorite courses at Syracuse was journalism ethics. I love learning about those things, the do's and don'ts, what you shouldn't do, what you shouldn't say, what you shouldn't take, all these things and more. So the topic of media, the topic of journalism really interested me. And when I looked at the landscape, I'm a huge baseball fan, loved the Montreal Expos growing up. I'm a gigantic NBA fan. I was a huge Knicks fan growing up, all that and more. But when I saw the landscape and I just looked around, I said, there's not a lot of great journalism being done in this sport that I'm interested in. And it's essentially 8 years old at the time that I told my parents about it. I felt like there was an opportunity to climb the ladder a little quicker.
How did it go over with them? You've got a mother from Lebanon, a father from Egypt, and you're like, I want to be the Howard Cosell of MMA. How'd that one fly?
They could not have been more supportive. Till this day, I do that show on Monday that is now 3 hours long. It used to be 5 hours long at my previous employer. Every single thing that I do, I kid you not, my mother watches every single second of it. Till this day, she does not miss a single episode. If I'm on SportsCenter, she asks me what time. She'll record it. She'll send it back to me via her phone. They couldn't have been bigger fans of mine when I said it, you know, back in 2001 and until this day. So
wait, does she know her shit? Like, can she talk to you?
Like,
no, but I'm saying, like, when she's talking about MMA, does she call you like, did you see Bones Jones? I've never seen anyone better.
Yeah, no joke. She'll say, like, why did you even think that Conor had a chance against Khabib? He had no chance against him. He doesn't have a ground game. And I was like, wow, this is amazing stuff. She will look at a matchup, like, I'll report a fight, and she'll send me the screen grab. And then she'll, like, say, oh, this is obvious. So-and-so is going to win this fight. She knows everyone. She knows them by face now. And then she'll say, like, oh, I can't believe you're having this guy back on the show. This guy annoys me. Oh, I'm excited to hear from this guy. Some of her favorite fighters, Uriah Faber, Carlos Condit, like, she likes the hardcores. Like, she's not just some casual fan. She's legit.
If I were talking to your mom right now, what would be her honest opinions of Dana White?
Well, she's my mother, and you know, she obviously will always support me and have my back more so than anyone on this earth. So she has obviously been upset about some of the things, in particular, you know, taking away jobs of mine and my livelihood. She does not like that. She doesn't like, you know, she gets mad about things like that. She gets mad when guys like Rampage Jackson, you know, get physical with me, or Nate Diaz sort of threaten me. She always feels very uncomfortable. She tells me to watch out. She says, why do you have to ask these questions? So, yes, she does have her opinions on those who may seem to be my foil.
Do you explain to her, Mom, if I'm going to be the Cosell of MMA, that's exactly the way that needs to go with Diaz and Rampage?
I say to her, I'm okay. I'm not worried. It's all good. And she says, please be careful. You know, like she's a classic, you know, Middle Eastern mom. So she just says, I worry about you sometimes. But it's amazing. Like, I won't even sense. I will go out of my way to not even mention those quote-unquote controversial interviews, and she finds them. She finds, like, she's on my Twitter. She gets my notifications. So everything I tweet, she sees. So I can't really hide from her.
In what ways are you imprinted by Lebanon and Egypt?
Well, to be honest, I feel like I'm more imprinted by Israel. I'm Jewish. I'm very proud to be Jewish. I went to Jewish school growing up, elementary. I didn't go to, like, Hebrew school. Like, my school was a private Jewish school, and I'm very proud to be Jewish. My parents are Jewish as well, so at first glance, I think people would hear, you know, Egypt, Lebanon, you wouldn't think that, but my parents and my grandparents on my mom's side were actually kidnapped by the PLO in 1980 because they had a jewelry store in Beirut, and a neighbor of theirs wanted their location, so he called the PLO on them, and the PLO came and kidnapped them in the middle of the night and put them in jail. And it just so happened that my grandmother was friends with one of Yasser Arafat's wives, and she put in a good word and got them released from jail. And so they have struggled a lot, especially growing up there. And so being Jewish, being Canadian, has been a big part of my identity. And I think part of why I maybe lean towards the underdog, I feel like, you know, even in this world, living in America, I'm the underdog. I'm a Canadian Jew with parents from the Middle East. So I would say more so than Egypt and Lebanon, I have an affinity for those countries. I've been to Egypt. I haven't been to Lebanon because it's not really safe for us to go. I'm very proud that, you know, I'm first generation and that, you know, I have those roots.
How did they end up in Canada?
So they wanted to come to the United States, but it was a lot harder to get a visa. So they ended up coming to Montreal because my mom's aunt was here first. Her husband was a Canadian doctor, so she came to Montreal first, and so they all just sort of followed. That's kind of how these things go. The first person goes, and then everyone just follows suit. And it's pretty amazing because, like, my dad associates, and I think you could relate to this story as well, given your background. Like, my dad is so proud to be Canadian. He would never leave Montreal. I think he's more proud to be Canadian than to be, you know, from Egypt. You know, he got a job sweeping a factory late nights. I mean, he had an accounting degree, but it's very hard to get a job when you come to Canada, to North America. And he ended up owning the entire business. So my work ethic, I hardly sleep. I'm relentless. I care deeply. It all comes from my parents and in particular my dad in that regard, because I've never seen a person who works harder than him.
Is that what it is? I was going to ask you where the ambition comes from, because
yeah,
you have been singularly focused on this goal for a while, and you sort of made it happen through sheer will.
Yeah, it's 100% watching my dad go to work at like 7 a.m., come home at like 8 p.m., continue to work. He used to have this box of papers. I remember it vividly, and I'd always ask him, like, don't you take a break? When do you get to watch TV? And he just would keep going. He'd keep going, and he's still doing that job, thank God, till this day. So it's 100% from that. I'm obsessed with trying to be the best, or at least putting out the best product for the audience, because I feel, and we can get to this later, I feel like I work for the people. I don't feel necessarily, like, I am employed by ESPN now, but at the end of the day, I feel like I answer to the people. And if they say that they don't like something that I'm doing, they're not happy with something I'm doing, that actually means a lot more to me than anything else, because I feel like they made me and they actually saved me as well. And if I'm not answering to them every day, doing my best every day for them, I feel like I let them down.
What is your sleep schedule like?
Well, I have three children, so they are 6, 5, and 2, so it isn't great. My wife and I will probably go to bed around 12:01 because I feel like my mind is going a million miles an hour with, you know, social media and texts and talking to people constantly, and then I'll wake up around 5:45, 6. But I love to sleep. Like, I prefer to have, like, a good 8 hours. It just doesn't work out. Plus, we just got a dog now, so that's been a mess of a situation. So there's not a lot of sleep happening, but I can't complain.
Why not, though, tap the brakes a little bit, have perspective, meditate, slow it down a little bit? You have arrived. I understand that someone as ambitious as you probably doesn't look at it that way, especially when websites keep closing around you. But you have arrived. You're the signature reporter in that sport.
I appreciate it. Are you able to do that? Like, are you able to meditate and you know, take it easy?
I have been able to get there after many years, but I'm older than you because I recognize the stuff that you're talking about. Like, I recognize the spinning fishing reel of your head's just always thinking something absurd. I've got to do my job better.
I don't even know the best way to describe it. Like, when I try to go to bed, it feels like I need to, like, slow down my brain because I'm constantly talking to myself and thinking and asking myself and saying, oh, I have to reach out to this person. For example, my show on Mondays that you referenced, there's usually 9 to 10 guests a week on that show. I book every single one myself. I just don't feel comfortable pawning that off on someone else. And I've been doing the show for almost 10 years now, 10 years in June. And so that's a job in its own right. And so I'm constantly reaching out to people, bugging them, in addition to looking for stories and news and content and all that stuff and more. So it does get overwhelming at times. And the other thing is there is no off-season in the sport, so we never have an opportunity to take a breath and take a step back and just look at the landscape. So it's constantly one week to the next, fight, 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 and there's new stories every week. Like, the event this weekend is completely different than the event last weekend, with different fighters and different storylines and different stakes and all this stuff. So it is, at times, relentless and exhausting, but, I mean, look what I'm doing. I'm covering MMA for a living, so I can't really complain.
Oh, but there are many moments of great displeasure and discomfort,
yes.
And I'm just wondering, when is the first time you realize, oh, wait a minute, the boss of this sport, Dana White, the guy with the microphone, the guy who can bully people, this guy's not here for the journalism of my job?
So I had heard from other people that, you know, Dana has a temper. Dana will get mad at the media. Dana has banned the media at times. And when I started, for several years, the most accessible and the nicest subject in the sport towards me was Dana White. I mean, he could not have been more accessible and more willing to give me his time and do interviews with me. It was incredible. And I remember on several occasions, you know, I'm younger. I'm trying to just feel my way through the game. I've asked him off camera, like, hey, do you mind if I ask you about this controversial thing? And multiple times he stopped me, don't ask me, just ask. Don't ask for my permission, you're good, don't worry about pissing me off, this and that. I even had a conversation with him one time where I remember this vividly, like, I broke a story, his PR team was mad at me for breaking it, I got on the phone with him, he was getting his kids ready for school, and he's like, look, your job is to piss people off, you're going to report things that we don't want out there, but if it's right, don't worry about it. Don't even think twice. I was like, wow, great. I got the green light. You know, I've got the blessing from the Don. So I'd always heard that he had issues with people and that he had a temper and all. I never felt it. And I remember the first time that I felt it, I got the call. I had reported something, and he called me yelling that I screwed things up, like yelling atop his lungs. And to be honest, it was a relief because I was like, oh, I finally got the call. I finally felt his wrath. And so that was, if memory serves me correct, around 2013 that I reported this one story. And that's when I started to feel like, okay, now he sort of views me as one of the media guys, and it's all fair game. And when I went to work for Fox in 2012, that really was sort of the beginning of the end of our relationship. So I started covering the sport, as I said, 2007, 2008, got the job at Fox almost literally 10 years to the day that I told my parents that I wanted to be the co-sell, and there was going to be some executive in some office, and they told me, like, we're going to do journalism here. We want you to come and cover the sport. That ended up not being the case at all. And it's really when, you know, the lines got blurred a little bit because of my job at Fox that it felt like things were slowly starting to change between us.
I want to ask what happened exactly, but you said there was relief that he was calling and screaming at you angry?
Yeah.
Relief?
Yeah, because I felt like, okay, I finally sort of you know, I got that one out of the way, you know, because I knew it was coming. People kept telling me, like, oh, you haven't felt his wrath? You haven't gotten Dana call? Like, you haven't heard him yell at you, anything like that? And I'd say, no, we're pretty good. You know, every time I ask him for an interview, he does it. When Anderson Silva went crazy in Abu Dhabi at UFC 112 and, like, completely embarrassed the company, their new owners were there from Abu Dhabi, and he was livid. Like, his face was beet red. I went up to him right after the press conference. I mean, he could not have been more upset with Anderson. I said, Dana, do you have 5 minutes? He said, yeah. He said, you know, let's do it now. Let's make it quick, but sure. And that video did over 1 million views in like 12 hours because it was him, you know, just so upset. So I never felt the wrath. So then once I got it, I felt like, okay, at least that's out of the way. And now I can really begin my career. That's the way I thought of it.
Have you felt along the path that he's trying to get you fired?
Well, yeah, well, first of all, he has got me fired. And yes, I have felt along the way in other instances. Yes. I dodged multiple bullets when I was working for Fox. When the first one started in 2014, I went to cover a Bellator media day. It was the first Bellator event. Bellator is sort of like the number two. It's kind of the CFL to the UFC's NFL, if you will. They're owned by Viacom, and I went to one of their media days. First event that I've ever gone. I've never been to a fight, press conference, whatever. They were having a media day 10 minutes from my house. So I went, and I tweeted that I was there and whatnot. And then a few days later, I was on Twitter, and I was like, you know what? I haven't seen any tweets from the UFC. This is bizarre. And then I went to Dana's Twitter page, blocked. Lorenzo Fertitta, blocked. UFC, blocked. UFC News, blocked. UFC Espanol, UFC Europe, all blocked me. And I was like, what is going on here? And so it took me actually a week to figure out what was going on. They all ignored me. I was told I no longer work for Fox anymore. There was an event coming up. I'm like, that's it? It's over? Just because of that? No one's going to give me a reason? And I was told that Lorenzo was upset that I went to the Bellator media day. I'm supposed to be their guy. Why are you going to the competition's media day? And they just ex-nayed me. And so I reached out to Dana. Finally, he reached back. And we had a sit-down in Chicago for 2 hours. And I was just sort of explaining. I was like, look, I don't want the Fox job back. If I'm being honest, I didn't really like working there. I didn't feel like they treated me very well. So I just want to be cool with you. I don't want to be blocked. Like, I just want to do my job. I want to get my credentials. Like, I just want to be, you know, who I always wanted to be in this sport. And we cleared the air. We were good. But that was, like, the first time that, you know, I felt the wrath. I eventually got the Fox job back. The next day he called me. He's like, hey, I got you the job back. I was like, all right, great. But that was, like, the first time that it started to, like, really affect my employment, if you will.
Well, what is it, though? Does he want control over the news? Is it that he's a control freak? Like, what are the things that you're doing? Because you're really responsible. You're more journalistically sound than anyone in the history of the sport has been, and you're just generally more responsible than he is.
Well, you know, I think he's very passionate, and I appreciate and respect that. It's his baby, and they poured a lot into the sport when no one really cared about it when they bought the company in 2000, 2001. They fought for media. They fought for coverage. They weren't getting a lot of coverage. I think they always wanted to be accepted by the mainstream media, and they felt like, oh, the MMA media is just always going to be there, so we can kind of, you know, it's sort of like the girl that's always there, but you want the girl at the end of the bar who's not really paying attention to you. That's the one that really is of great interest to you, and that's kind of their relationship with the media. And I'll be fully honest, you know, the day that I, you know, the Monday after I got banned, I know I'm skipping some steps here, but I did a show where I kind of laid out the entire history of my relationship with the UFC and Dana and Fox, and something happened when I started that probably affected things that put me in a really tough spot, and it's something I'm not proud of. But they told me that if you want to be on the Fox broadcast, you have to get paid by the UFC. And I fought it. I have the emails. I got an agent as a result of it. I tried every way possible. I was like, I don't want to be paid by the UFC. I can't be paid by the UFC. I'm a Syracuse University grad. I went to ethics classes and all these things. That can't happen. And they're like, look, you're either going to be on TV and take this, or we got to let you go. And at the time, I had to make a decision. Like, do I want to be co-sell or do I not? And the way I justified it was, well, Fox is paying the UFC for this. I know they're paying them for production, and that money is just essentially taking a detour and coming to me. Okay, fine. If the UFC ever asked me to do anything else for, like, UFC.com or whatever, I always said no. But I wanted that Fox job holding that mic flag, and so I did it. And I feel like that was part of my undoing as well, and it's the biggest regret of my career, and I would never do it again. And I just was put in a really tough spot there. And I wish they would have had my back, but they didn't.
That's a brutal spot, that you're sitting there caring about something that literally no one in that world cares about, your ethics. Like, that is something that only you're caring about there.
And you know, it really was tough. It wasn't like, okay, I won't take this job. I can go to X, Y, and Z network. There's literally one place that is airing the UFC that cares about MMA, you know, content. ESPN wasn't really covering it the way they are now, of course, and there just wasn't any other options. This is your chance, finally, to get on TV. Kid from Montreal, you knew no one in this sport. Here you are 4 years after you started this, and now you could be on TV. You could be the backstage reporter. You could be the co-sell if you want to be. This is the beginning of the journey. Am I going to turn it down because of, you know, my quote unquote ethics, or am I just going to go with it and see where things? And I had a 1-year deal. I lasted 5 years with Fox, and at the beginning of every year, I would say, "Can we please revisit this? Can we figure out a way to like just? Can you just pay me? Like, what's the big deal? You're paying them to then pay me." And they did not care, and it really bummed me out. And that's why when he let me go, it was a relief, because I hated it. It was a huge burden on my life. I felt like I couldn't look myself in the mirror. So it felt like actually like a relief when he let me go, because I didn't have to deal with that anymore.
You thought you were a sellout? Like
I thought I was a sellout. Yeah, I was ashamed of myself, and it's something that comes. Like, fans will bring this up to me now, like, "Oh, you took a check from them," but they don't realize that it was Fox's money. But fine, okay, you want to say that, it's fine. I had no other choice. It was either, if I don't take that job and do that job for 5 years, I don't know if I am where I am now, and I'm not taking any, you know, money from them, you know, even though the UFC and ESPN.
But that's why I think you shouldn't regret it as much as you do. Like, you made, I understand you want to achieve a higher principle and you want to be the guy that they taught at Syracuse to abide by journalistic principles, but you're caring about something there that they don't care about. And furthermore, because of the lack of options, I'm not sure that you actually do regret it, even as I believe you. I'm not saying you're lying. Like, how can you regret it? Your career would have been derailed at that point.
Yeah, I'd like to think that I would have figured out a way, but yeah, you're probably right. In the end, it probably muddied the waters, but it was also part of my undoing, because I tried to keep it real. Basically, I had the Fox job, but I also had a website job with SB Nation, and they were like two different lives. So with SB Nation, I was completely independent, and they would increasingly get mad at me for talking about things like unions and free agency and the competition. And that was in March of 2016. That was my undoing. Rory McDonald, who was a UFC star, came on my show for SB Nation and talked about how he was unhappy with his contract and he wanted to test free agency. And to the best of my knowledge, the UFC brass found out about it, and they said, "Enough is enough with this guy. Get rid of him." And it was literally after 5 years, a 2-minute phone call where they said, "We got to go. We're done." And I said, "Why?" And they said, "Because the UFC asked us to." And then that was it. And then when I get that call and I'm done, and now I'm not beholden to anyone, and in my mind, okay, I could go back to being me and the shackles are off, then being the, you know, I will admit, somewhat emotional and competitive person that I am, I just said, I'm going to break every story under the sun now. All these stories that I was asked to sit on because Fox was asking me to, I'm just going to go, as the kids say, ham and break everything. And the UFC, I kid you not, Dan, the UFC was convinced that there was a mole in the company, a singular mole telling me this information. They could not wrap their head around the idea that I was breaking this news just via sources. And so they would come up to people in their office and close the door and say, "Let me see your phone. Let me see if you've texted with Ariel, if you've called Ariel." They thought that I had a number that I would like patch in through their conference calls, and they would throw out fake fights and wait to see if I broke them. They never got me. It wasn't true. There was no mole. I was just doing what I do now. I just had sources and whatnot, but they were so convinced that I had a mole that it became like this crazy witch hunt to try to find it. And that's what led to the Brock Lesnar thing, because the Brock Lesnar, so it was from March to June of that year where I just broke all these stories, and the Brock one was so big to them, I guess, that they were just like, okay, enough is enough. We're done.
Help me understand something here, because I want to get to the Brock Lesnar stuff. But if I had to guess, and I don't have the facts here, the details, so you help me fill in some of the gaps. The Fertitta brothers are these casino brothers. They settle their disputes by actually physically wrestling to see who wins. They've got Dana White as the carnival barker there. I'm guessing that these three people, beyond not having any use for journalism, they're not liking at all, first and foremost, that you keep pointing out the injustice of how the fighters are paid.
No, and I actually believe deep, deep down inside, perhaps I'm crazy, I actually believe that Dana still likes me till this day. Dana and I had a very good relationship. I had essentially non-existent relationship with Lorenzo, and Frank Fertitta just was never around. He was more of like an investor and would show up to the big events, but he never spoke to the media. For some reason, I always got the impression that Lorenzo didn't like me, and why did I get that impression? Because Lorenzo is a very savvy businessman. He's the kind of guy who reads the trades, if you will. So I think that he kept tabs on me a lot more and would listen to all the things I was saying and reading things I was saying. None of it unfair, in my opinion. None of it, you know, unfounded.
Oh, but I can see how somebody with no journalism training would say, wait a minute, I'm paying this f***er and he's reporting this stuff about my business. I don't want him here.
That's 100% it. That's, so he would tell Dana, like, this guy's not loyal, this guy's not this, this guy's not that. And in the end, it was him who made the decision to ban me. And I'll never forget when I was banned, Dana said these words that stuck with me because I thought, wow, that's a weird analogy to make. He said, Lorenzo put a bullet in your head. Your career is over. And I was like, woo, that is pretty intense thing to hear from, you know, from Lorenzo Fertitta, so via Dana White. So it was his call, and I think it's because he was getting increasingly annoyed that I was talking about these things. And again, I feel uncomfortable when I'm made out to be some sort of journalism martyr for this stuff, because this is like the most benign stuff. I'm not doing any exposés. I'm not doing an investigative report.
You're covering that sport the way ESPN covers all sports.
Yes, you're transactions.
Responsibly, though. You're not sitting there reporting things that are wrong. To me, your story's fascinating for a number of different reasons, but that's one of them, that you're trying to apply these Syracuse learned ethics to a place that sold for $4.2 billion, where they're signing the paperwork and the back deals on alleys after, what was the fight? When was the fight that they renewed at Fox?
The spike. Forrest Griffin, Stephen Bonner, the Ultimate Fighter 1 finale in 2005.
So they come from an alley to $4.2 billion, and along that path, they got no time for you. They want ESPN because they want the mainstream media to pay attention to what they're doing because they're a bit of a bastard child. But when you're doing the ESPN work, they're not having any of it.
No. I mean, I'm, you know, along the way, more people were starting to, like, the media corps has come a very long way since when I started. But the conversation that I had, which, by the way, I've reminded them of, like, hey, what about, you know, just if I'm right, it's all good. You can piss people off, all that stuff and more. They want the coverage to be more like pro wrestling in the sense that they want there to be a curtain and they want to tell you what should be reported, what should be out there. And if you watch their broadcast, they produce their broadcast. So they'll skim through certain things like, oh, this guy who's coming off a, you know, steroid suspension, he's been out for a year, but, you know, he says that he's really, you know, excited about this new chapter. Well, why was he out for a year? Like, that wouldn't happen in other sports, but it's because they control everything.
I was stunned that ESPN gave them all that money and then also let them produce everything.
I was a little bit surprised as well, only because I had heard that was a sticking point in the past, not only with ESPN, but with other networks that they were trying to, you know, to do business with. In the end, I think the general thinking is they do it best, they know it best, which they do. So because it's such a foreign sport to so many people, like, why bring in foreigners essentially to do what's working? But that certainly does lead to potential issues. And, you know, even now, like, I'm not on the broadcast now, but other people are that work with me, and I get a lot of tweets during the broadcast where people are like, well, why aren't you there? I see Chael on the broadcast, but why aren't you there? And that's probably not all my doing, right? But honestly, I don't really want to be, because I feel like that will lead down the same path. I don't want to go down that path. I don't want to make the same mistakes again.
So, Fertitta, you're hearing bullet in your head of your career. You're hearing that, and are you saying, yeah, he's probably right. That's true.
Oh, yeah. So what happened was, I break McGregor-Diaz 2, and I'm sitting in the forum media room. So, usually I'm breaking a story, I'm doing something at home, at work, whatever. I'm not actually in the media room, but it just so happened to be a fight. It was UFC 199. And so I break that, and then the head of PR at the time comes up to me, and he says, you know that story was wrong, right? And I said, I'm pretty sure it was right. He's like, well, you should have reached out to us. But what they would do to me was I would reach out to them for confirmation, and then they would go tip off one of their other media friends and tell them that I know and get them to report it first. So I just stopped reaching out to them. Like, I'm not doing this anymore. What do I need your confirmation? If you don't want to play the game where it's like, I'm going to reach out to you for comment, you're going to do that, then forget it. I'm not playing that game anymore. And so he tells me I'm wrong. I tell him I'm right. And I said, by the way, I got another one coming too. And he said, all right, we'll look out for that. This particular guy did not really like me very much. And so I sat there. I got the Lesnar thing confirmed. I wrote it. And then I started to get texts and messages that they were very mad because they were planning on announcing it on the broadcast later that night, which I didn't even know about, but that was what I had heard. So he comes back a little while later and says, you need to come to the back and speak to Dana. And I said, you know, I'm just going to watch the rest of the card and maybe we can talk about this later. Leaves, comes back, and says, you really need to come back now. And so I told him that I wanted to bring my cameraman with me, not to record it, but just because I felt like I needed backup in case something went awry. And I'll never forget, they took me to the back. Dana's standing there. He's wearing all black. His sleeves are rolled up. And he said, "You're out. You're done. Get out of here." And I said, "What did I do?" He said, "You almost screwed up the deal. You didn't ask us for confirmation. You got it via some weird way. Lorenzo just put a bullet in your head. You're done. You're never allowed back here. You'll never cover this sport again. You won't get credentials again. Give me your credential." And then he even took my cameraman's credential. My cameraman, his wife is a very famous photographer in the sport, and he instructed that PR escort her out as well. And I told him, "You remember that time we spoke and you told me that, like, if I'm right, it's all good? And what's the difference, by the way, between, like, what I just did and what Woj does and Schefter?" I literally mentioned those two names because obviously they're the best in their respective sports. Didn't really have an answer for me. I shook his hand. I said, "Dana, if we never speak again, I just want to tell you thank you for everything that you did for me, because without you, I'm not standing here, and I really appreciate it. And for me, there's no hard feelings. I'm sorry that you feel this way right now. I hope that you'll change your mind, but I'm not going to create a stink here. I'm just going to leave, but I just wanted to thank you."
In the moment. How did you do that in the moment? Like, how are you not scared? How are you not physically intimidated? How are you not surprised? There are rolled up sleeves. Like, what are you doing?
I don't know. I don't know why. I will tell you, those emotions came shortly thereafter. But in the moment, I felt like that was the right thing to do, because I honestly believe till this day that he didn't want to do that. I believe that he was being told to do that. Now, he may feel differently about me now, and maybe he truly does dislike me, whatever the case, but I didn't. We had been through, when my first child was born, he sent me like a basket of like clothes and candy and all this stuff. Like, I actually think that I'm a Bills fan, he's a Patriots fan. He would make fun of me all the time when they beat the Bills and all this stuff. Like, I think we had a nice working relationship, and I didn't think he wanted to do that. That was what I told myself. And so they take us out, we're in the parking lot. I open my phone, and I see that Michael Bisping just pulled off one of the greatest upsets in UFC title fight history and just became champion, and I missed it. So I send out, like, three tweets and saying, essentially, like, "I'm sorry that we're not going to have our usual coverage. I've been escorted out. You know, I hope that this is not the end of my career. Thank you, you know, to everyone who supported me, and I'll talk to you soon." And I went back to my hotel, and that's when I started to get scared. That's when I got emotional. And honestly, one of the very first people to call me, and I even get emotional just retelling the story, it was actually Daniel Cormier, the current UFC heavyweight champion, and he asked me, you know, "What's wrong? And don't worry, buddy, we're going to figure this out." And I just was blown away that he would do that. He even tweeted in support of me. But I was very scared. I actually went to the airport 7 hours early because I was afraid that someone was going to come to my hotel room and like kidnap me or something. So I just wanted to get the hell out of there.
Kidnap you?
Yeah, I was afraid of that.
Kidnap you?
I didn't know what. I mean, you hear bullet in your head, you hear things like that. I was spooked, and obviously I was overreacting, but I was definitely worried. And it was also 1 a.m. or later, because the pay-per-view ended at 10 Pacific, 1 a.m. Eastern, and by now it's probably like 2 a.m. My wife is sleeping, my parents are sleeping. I don't know who to talk to. I don't know. There was no one to talk to. That's why the Cormier call really sticks with me. I just took my stuff, I went to the airport, I sat there, I didn't know what, and then eventually, like, the news started to get out, but my flight was at, like, 6 a.m., so I'll never forget turning on the Wi-Fi on the plane and opening my Twitter and then seeing this thing explode and then seeing, you know, all these famous journalists, you know, take interest in it, tweeting about it. I don't know if it was you, but your Twitter account DM'd me and asked me to come on the show, and I was like, I can't believe that this has broken through the bubble, because what they don't want is exactly that. They want this to remain in the bubble because they've done this to other journalists before. They have banned other journalists who are still unfortunately banned to this day for other reasons, and they want to keep this in the bubble, and now it's starting to break out. Maybe this is how I'm going to get saved. And it started to become this thing. And honestly, I didn't want to do any interviews because I didn't really know how to handle it. But then I spoke to some people, and they told me, no, you should go out. You should tell your story. And so that Monday morning, I did a few interviews and got the word out a little bit, and then I went on the air do my own show. I canceled all the other guests because I didn't feel like it was appropriate to do that, and I just, for 2.5 hours straight, told the entire story of what had happened from, you know, the beginning to the end till Saturday night. And honestly, as I left, I walked home that day, I'll never forget it, I kind of, again, felt relieved and felt like, okay, this is my new reality. I'm banned. I got to figure this out like I figured it out in the past. I'm not a quitter. I believe I'm a fighter in a different sense of the world. I'm not going to let them bully me. I'm just going to have to figure this out. And even when I did that show, Dana went on TMZ at the same time and doubled down. That's just the kind of guy that he is. He is a fighter as well, and he did an interview saying the only time I would ever be allowed back at a UFC event is if I bought a ticket. So he was not listening to the backlash, and there was this thing that was happening where the UFC has this streaming service, UFC Fight Pass, and a lot of fans were posting screen grabs of their cancellation of their subscription with the hashtag Free Helwani, and it was becoming a thing. And so at around 7 p.m. that night, the COO of the company reached out to my boss, and I was shocked, saying, like, how do we fix this?
You did the right thing by doing interviews, because then you got a whole lot of people behind you. They saw that you were being bullied.
Yeah, it was, in hindsight, the absolute best thing that I could have done, and especially the outlets that I spoke to, like yours, which I'll forever be grateful for, Dan Patrick and Rich Eisen, people like that. Richel Nichols tweeted on my behalf, Frank Isola tweeted on my behalf. Like, it really meant a lot to me, because I didn't know any of you.
Ariel, you're as good as all of those people you're mentioning. Seriously, like, what you've done in that sport, with a harder degree of difficulty, I might add, because most of us weren't dealing with that bullshit. We weren't dealing with bullshit like rolled up, meathead carnival barker coming at us, bullet in your head from the casino owner. That's not what we were dealing with. The biggest decision I had to make is, do I want the Chinese buffet or do I want to order in?
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. I don't agree, but I appreciate that. And it just was surreal to me to see those people talk about me or to be guests on your show. And you're always taught, again, going back to Syracuse, you're not supposed to be the story. You're supposed to cover the stories. And I was very uncomfortable. And in fact, my first ever appearance on ESPN in any way, shape, or form was that night. And I'll forever be grateful to Scott Van Pelt, who reached out and asked me to come on his show to speak about the story. And I did the interview with him from my home. And then, amazingly, right after the interview was over, so I'm doing the interview as the band journalist, right after the interview was over, that's when they call my boss, and then the wheels start to turn. And in the midst of all that, which I think you know who this individual is, Kimbo Slice dies. Literally like 30 minutes later, word gets out that he died, and he actually has meant a lot to my career, was always very nice to me, and one of the greatest characters that the sport has ever seen. So that was surreal in its own right. And then they put out a press release, the UFC does, that I've been unbanned, but they take a shot at me, by the way, in the press release, saying that I'd been practicing unethical journalistic practices and all this nonsense, which what it was, whatever. So then Scott Van Pelt calls me back and says, like, hey, you're unbanned? Like, you got to come back and do, like, the live interview now and talk about what happened and also talk about Kimbo. Surreal is the best way to describe those 48 hours because, like, first of all, I always wanted to work for ESPN. It was my dream. And now I'm appearing on ESPN for the first time to talk about myself. That wasn't the way I really planned it, but it was kind of a nice way to end that crazy 48 hours.
Well, this is also funny because I'm guessing, you tell me if I have this right, that the safest, most secure, most arrived, most professional that you allowed yourself to feel as someone ambitious who's never going to allow himself to feel too much of that is when you get to ESPN with your own paycheck from ESPN that's not tied to the UFC. And then how many months later does Dana White show up again at ESPN?
So I signed with ESPN in April, and then they announced the UFC deal in May, so literally a month later.
But so you had a month of freedom, a month where you're like, okay, I got a job now. No one's going to, it's not going to be combat sports that include me being one of the combatants.
Yes, and I had no idea. It never came up. And so I will admit I'd be lying if I said that thoughts weren't going through my mind. I'm scarred from this, right? And I'm always afraid. I mean, this is a totally different story, but I was hired by Showtime to cover Mayweather McGregor for them, the world tour. So they were in L.A., in Toronto, in Brooklyn, in England, and I was covered to host their coverage of the world tour for Mayweather McGregor. I took a red-eye from New York. This is in 2017. I took a red-eye New York to L.A. I get to the Staples Center. The show's about to be in an hour, and Steven Espinoza, the head of Showtime Sports, asks to meet with me in the hotel next door. And he said, I've just been dealing with this thing for 24 hours. I'm really sorry, but you can't be on our coverage. Dana White doesn't want you on the coverage. I was like, I just flew here. This is a huge opportunity. This is my chance to get back on TV. Mayweather McGregor and this guy stopping me again. And it was heartbreaking. I will say, though, for anyone who cares, the way Steven Espinoza handled that face-to-face, I never worked for him for a second and even agreed to still pay me. I'd even asked, but he said, I'm still going to pay you. was a million times classier and more thoughtful than what Fox did. And I'll forever be appreciative of how he handled that. But that was heartbreaking in its own right. So, like, you know, I forever feel like, okay, when's it coming? When's it coming? Is my ESPN job going to be taken away? But to everyone at ESPN's credit, they all told me from the beginning, you have nothing to worry about. This isn't Fox. You're not going to go through that again. And that has remained true almost 9 months later.
I'm curious, though, because Fertitta doesn't have to respect anything when he's the owner. But even if he's acting on orders from Fertitta, isn't Dana White being uncommonly vindictive?
I mean, I think you can argue that. Worth noting, Fertitta is no longer around, right? He sold the company. So I actually think when I got unbanned, it was a month before they finalized the deal. I've never been told this 100%. Like, I would never come out and say this is accurate, but there's a part of me that feels like that helps me as well, because if I'm WME and I'm looking at this story, I'm asking myself, why are we doing this? This seems like unnecessary bad press. And so the sport, it feels like to a degree, has changed a little bit. It's no longer just three guys from Las Vegas running it. It's a real, you know, or to a degree, it's still a lot different than the other sports, but WME owns it. There's investors. There's all this stuff and more. So it definitely feels like it has a bit of a different vibe. And I don't think, especially after what happened to me, I hope no other journalists ever feel that fear, because they can't do that again. They can't go back that well. And, in fact, one of the best byproducts of what happened was we started a MMA Journalist Association, which I'm very proud of as well. So hopefully with things like that in place, it's still in its embryonic stages, but it is a thing. There's a website, all that stuff and more. Hopefully what happened to me will never happen to anyone ever again.
Really admire this dude's story, his work ethic, and just his work. His MMA show has new episodes every Monday and Wednesday. You should listen, download. You should subscribe on the ESPN app or Apple Podcasts. And he's also got on ESPN Plus and the ESPN app Ariel and the Bad Guy with Chael Sonnen, who's his good talking as anyone you've ever seen in the sport. Ariel, really appreciate your time and your honesty. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it as well. Go Expos.
Our thanks to Ariel Helwani for being on with us. His path has been an interesting one. He's very good at what he does. We're going to keep talking to interesting people about interesting things around here and keep asking you to rate, subscribe, and review. Support the Levitard and Friends stuff, including TISO as one of our sponsors.
TISO is a Levitard and Friends network sponsor, and we want to remind you, TISO is the official watch of the NBA, and each one of TISO's timepieces delivers quality performance and traditional luxury. The TISO Chrono XL is a great watch for those looking for a sporty chronograph with Swiss technology at an unbeatable price. Shop right now at us.tisoshop.com.
Thank you for listening. And again, support this stuff by rating, subscribing, and reviewing, and checking out the sponsors. If nothing else, checking out the sponsors that are paying for all this stuff.